Excellent. Calling our first case 83372, Free Speech Fund City Las Vegas, LLC. Council, will you state your appearances, please?
Andrew Gould for the appellant, along with Micah Ackles, also for the appellant.
Thank you.
Dan Pulsimer for respondents, Your
Honor. All right, thank you, Council. Are Council ready to proceed?
We are, Your Honor.
All right, then. Mr. Gould, and would you like to save any time for rebuttal?
Yes, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor.
All right, excellent. Please proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Andrew Gould for the appellant, Stephen Freese. In granting summary judgment for respondents, the district court committed three fundamental errors, two procedural and one substantive. First, in holding that Stephen could not maintain a wrongful death cause of action, the district court failed to apply the plain text of the wrongful death statute, which under the laws of this state, Arletta's disclaimer rendered Stephen as Keith's heir. Second, regardless, the district court erred in holding that the wrongful death statute provided Stephen's exclusive remedy when the survival of causes of action statute provide distinct claims for which Stephen could pursue. And third, on the merits, the district court erred in holding that the respondents, both Fund City defendants and the Gun Club, owed no duty of care. This court should correct these three errors of law, and it should reverse. I'm going to address the issues in that order, but I welcome the court's questions on any of the issues at any time. Beginning with the wrongful death issue, this is an issue of first impression for this court. And in resolving this issue, this court should follow the plain text of Section 4185. Subsection 2 states that an heir may maintain a wrongful death cause of action. And subsection 1 defines who an heir is. An heir is a person who, under the laws of this state, would be entitled to succeed to the separate property of the decedent had the decedent died intestate. The key phrase here is under the laws of this state, because that phrase shows the legislature's intent to incorporate the entirety of Nevada law, which includes the law of intestate succession and disclaimer.
May I ask a question, counsel? Were there any arguments that Florida law should apply to this case? And was there ever a determination by the Florida courts that Mr. Freese was in fact acknowledged or authorized to be a statutory heir?
So yes and yes. So Florida law applies only to the extent that this court wishes to consider what other states, how other states would construe its own statutes. Now, I don't disagree with respondents, which is that this is ultimately, it is about what Nevada law says. Florida law can inform that. But realistically, this court doesn't even need to look at Florida law. When we briefed it, the point was simply that this result is consistent with Florida law. As to your second question, Your Honor, was there a determination? There, and I apologize, and I can find this when I get back up for rebuttal, but there is in the record where Stephen in the Florida court was appointed administrator of Keith's estate. Now, the issue of heirship, that's specific as to this particular wrongful death claim, but that is in the record. And again, when I get up on rebuttal, I'd be happy to provide that record citation.
Thank you, counsel.
And under the laws of the state, again, there are two parts here, the intestate succession and the disclaimer part. The intestate succession is really, I don't think, in dispute, because if there is no spouse and there is no child, then it goes to the parent, and if not the parent, then a surviving sibling. So that's why it began with Arletta, who is Keith's mother, and then passed to Stephen, which is the brother. The disclaimer statute then comes into play. And under the disclaimer statute, it broadly allows the disclaimer over any interest in or power over property, including a power of appointment That's what occurred here. And then you get into section 120.230, which is how the about the timing of the disclaimer. And there's two parts here. First, you time it as if it was distributed as of the time of the intestate's death, so Keith's death. But second, and most critically here, you treat it under subsection 1C as if it passed at the time of the disclaimant's death, almost a hypothetical. Assume, for example, that Arletta predeceased Keith. That's what the law requires. And so at the moment that Stephen brought this suit, he was the heir. Again, and this just follows the plain text of the statute. So when respondents say the wrongful death statute should be strictly construed, even if we assume the premise to be correct, that you should adopt a strict construction of the statute, that doesn't give the court license to ignore the plain language of the statute. And this is a broadly written statute. Under the laws of this state is unique language that incorporates the entirety of this law.
And assuming that we adopt your position, how do you get around the apparent lack of damages that are in this case?
I'm not following how there are lack of damages. Keith was killed, and so he suffered wrongful death, and so he is in, so his heirs are entitled to the loss of support and companionship that the statute allows for heirs. And then on the survival statute, which I know gets into the second issue, but the survival statute then opens it up to the panoply of damages that Keith would have received had he not deceased.
Under the survival statute, doesn't it expressly exclude wrongful death actions?
So I believe you're referring to 41-100 subsection 3. And respectfully, I read that differently, which is I read that subsection as basically saying we are going to keep these two statutes different in terms of the damages. So we don't, for example, in this, and again, I'm going to, I guess, shift over to the survival because it overlaps with this. I think the Scott Court from the District of Nevada got it exactly right when it said what you can't do is you can't double recover under both statutes, that is, for the decedent's pain and suffering. We can't, for example, pursue a wrongful death claim and get damages under that wrongful death claim for Keith's pain and suffering, pre-death pain and suffering, and then come back around in the survival and get the same exact damages under that. But there's no possible harm in this case, because what will happen realistically is if this goes to trial, the jury is going to get a verdict form in which it lists out here are the damages. It's going to list out here are the blanks for Keith's damages pre-death, and then here are the damages for Stephen. We're not seeking double recovery. And again, so to get back to your question, Your Honor, we're aware of Section 41-100 subsection 3, but we don't read that as a prohibition on seeking damages under the survival statute. And, you know, if I may move on to the survival statute, which is that even if you were to disagree with me about the wrongful death statute, Stephen is still entitled to pursue his claims under the survival statute. The District of Nevada, which of course this court is not bound by, but they're uniform in this. Scott, Wesco, Perez, Soto, they all say there's no prohibition in bringing both of these claims. Again, what you cannot do is you simply can't double recover under that. And again, we're not seeking to do so here. The respondents say, but this court held in all sins that the wrongful death statute provides an exclusive remedy. But Alsons is distinguishable because there, the plaintiff said, well, what I'm actually pursuing as a wrongful death action is it's actually the survival action. That's not what we're doing here. We have distinct claims. We have a wrongful death claim based on the negligence causing death. And then we have separate claims that belong to Keith before he died for what he suffered, negligent training, supervision, as well as negligent infliction of emotional distress. He's entitled to pursue those claims. And finally, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Negligent infliction of emotional distress as to whom?
As to Keith. So as this court held in Schoen, which we cited our brief in our opening brief, and this is at 44 and 45, this court held that a direct victim can pursue a negligent infliction of emotional distress claim. It was the emotional distress that he suffered after being shot. And briefly, before I sit down for see the rest of my time for rebuttal, on the merits, the district court overlooked the facts and the record that establish both the gun club's duty of care as well as the Fun City defendants. And as to the gun club undertook to provide security services, and when Mr. Trevathan acted, he was acting within the scope of those services. And as to the Fun City defendants, there are multiple theories on which they can be held liable, whether that's through constructive employment, that effectively they were employing Mr. Trevathan through their compensation of in-kind lodging, delegation of authority that he had, and finally, the innkeeper liability statute, even if he's not an employee. And with that, I'll say the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the court, Dan Poulsenberg for respondents. This is a case of line drawing, of legislative line drawing. In 1979, when the Nevada legislature reenacted the wrongful death statute, they did a couple of things to change the way it had used to be. Remember, it used to be the wrongful death statute. I say remember, although I'm the oldest person in the room, and I don't remember this. Before 1979, the wrongful death statute was 41.080, and it didn't say who heirs were, and it didn't allow recovery for conscious pain and suffering. What it did is, without mentioning 12.080 and 090, this court has interpreted that those statutes listed out who could sue for wrongful death. So there's a great change in 1979. They expand the statute and they list out who the heirs are who can recover under both the Lord Campbell version of the statute and the survival version. And it says that an heir is a person who, under the laws of the state, would be entitled to succeed to the decedent's separate property. So what the legislature did there is it took some lines that were already drawn in the intestacy statute, and it mentioned them. It didn't mention by name 134 because statutes can change, but here were the lines that were already drawn. You know, I always thought that was a brilliant move on their part. Because if you look at the legislative history, the Senate Judiciary Committee was struggling on who should recover. Senator Herdstead asked Frank Dakin whether we could limit the degrees of consanguinity and make sure that the heirs are actual dependents. But instead, what they did was they referred to the intestacy statute. Here's why it's brilliant. I mean, look at, we mentioned today, negligent infliction of emotional distress. Look at bystander liability. This court has struggled in the common law to come up with lines where some people could recover and other people couldn't recover. The court at one point said, several points said closely related. Another point said it had to be a loved one. In the mid-90s, in a two-year period, this court voted 2-1-2 to say that a sister-in-law could recover, but the next year voted 3-2 saying that a fiance couldn't.
Mr. Holzmer, I guess my question has to do with the disclaimer of interest statute.
Yeah.
Which appears to, so it governs the disclaimer of interest in property, right? And it states that if the property interest arose under the law of intestate succession, which we have here, correct? The disclaimer takes effect at the time of the intestate's death, and the interest passes as if the disclaimant died immediately before the time of distribution. My understanding is that the mother, who would be the next in line in succession, disclaimed the interest. Why would the brother not now be able to enforce those rights as the next in line under the disclaimer of interest?
There are two different concepts.
Okay.
Intestacy and under Chapter 134 is even in a different title, let alone a different chapter from 120.
But don't you have to read them cohesively?
No, because they're two different things.
Okay.
The disclaimer statute says passed, as you quoted and as counsel quoted. Nothing passes in a wrongful death action. A cause of action is created at the time of the death. It is not a property right that belongs to the estate that passes to somebody else. So we just don't fall under the concept of disclaimer. Remember, renunciation is something that an heir can do if they don't want the particular property. Usually comes out when we're dealing with real property that has liens on it and has a negative value, or it could create tax consequences for the heir. So the heir can say, I don't want it. That's different from bringing a cause of action. Cause of action is created by the wrongful death statute at the time. Nothing passes. They're two entirely different concepts, and that's why they're in different titles in the Nevada revised.
But would you agree that the mother could have brought a wrongful death statute?
She could have. And see, she doesn't need to disclaim it or renounce it. She just doesn't bring it.
But why can she bring it but not the successor, the brother? So the brother...
Because the lines have been drawn by the legislature referring to the intestacy statute.
And the definition of heir is what you're saying.
Yes. And so you look at the as we say in the brief, the facts on the ground, what was the family situation at the time. You know, I went to law school in Boston, and there was a story, probably apocryphal, about a wills professor at Harvard having died intestate. And the reason he died intestate is because he had written the Massachusetts statutes on intestacy. So the property would be distributed just the way he would want. And that's what the legislature did when it came up with the intestacy statute. It says, remember, they were looking at how many degrees of consanguinity should an heir have, should they actually be dependent. They found a statutory scheme that already existed. And so they just looked at that. Now the heirs can't come in and change that. And you know, they make fun of me for saying this is an assignment, but this smacks as an assignment. So the heirs can come in and they can plot among themselves to change the lines that the legislature has drawn. So, you know, my spouse, my mother, my children, my grandmother, they can all do disclaimers so that they can get a distant relative that they want to recover. No, the line's been drawn. Council says this is an issue of first impression. I think it's a novel issue. And I don't mean that in a nice way. And that's why I brought up the idea that they had waived this. It's not so much, look, I'm an appellate lawyer. I believe in liberally allowing parties to come up with issues for appeal. This court has often told me I'm too liberal on that. But the reason that we bring up, I mean, it's kind of like Carl Llewellyn. The reason we bring up that they brought up this issue is so late is because even they didn't believe it. I don't think this is a valid issue. I don't think the court should adopt it.
What do you say about this negligent infliction of emotional distress as it applies to Keith?
Go ahead. If Keith were there and he were a bystander, then under this court's hand-wringing decisions, it would probably be a question for the jury whether he was closely enough related. But he doesn't qualify. Remember, it isn't just degrees of consanguinity for negligent infliction of emotional distress. You have to be present. In State versus Eaton, this court rejected um, the the touching requirement and went to the zone of danger. There are a lot of thresholds to be able to get there. And I think it is just a way, and it's very much like their argument on the survival statute, where they're just trying to find another way to get somewhere they can't get under the wrongful death statute. Yes, Allsent said that you can't bring a survival action where the cause of action that applies is the wrongful death action. Yes, 41.100 does exclude wrongful death actions. The legislature occupied the field. Now, this law has said, this court has said many times that there is no common law right to recover for wrongful death. But even if there were, the legislature has come in and occupied the field, and they say when a death is caused by the wrongful act or neglect of another, then the wrongful death action applies. And the survival action doesn't. And as I alluded to earlier, there is also a survival component in the 1979 wrongful death action. It used to be just a Lord Campbell's Act, where the heirs could recover for their loss of support. Now we also allow the heirs to recover for the conscious pain and suffering of the decedent.
Mr. Polsenberg, I'm sorry.
Chief Justice Stiglitz, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you, sir?
Very well, thank you.
Excellent. So, I might have forgot my question now, but let me, why?
Sorry, if I'd known that would have worked, I would have used it years
ago. Your courtesies shook me. I want to go back to the 085 and the discussion you're having with Justice Lee. It sounds like you're saying the legislature has drawn lines, but it sounds like you're asking us to draw lines. Because when I look at the entire statutory scheme and I read them, including the disclaimer arena and the heirs, it's not quite clear to me that there's some bright lines that preclude Stephen from being the heir in this context. It sounds more as if we are being asked to draw some lines, if you could comment.
No, I'm asking you to recognize the lines that the legislature has drawn. Bringing in disclaimer is an entirely different concept. It is nothing like what the Senate Judiciary Committee discussed when they were looking for limits. They weren't looking for people to be able to decide who should be heirs instead of themselves.
But that's not what they wrote. They wrote heirs under the laws of the state of Nevada, and one of the laws relates to disclaimer and the effect of that on the existing heirs. So what do I do with that piece?
Well, they weren't considering disclaimer. While disclaimer did exist before Chapter 120, the Uniform Act, clearly it was under a different chapter. 120 is much later than 1979. So when they are saying the laws of this state, I think they are meaning just the laws of this state, the lines that they have drawn, as opposed to whatever the law is in Florida. But I don't think it's a broad reference to any law ever, so that people would just comb the statutes and try to find something that would work as an assignment.
Can you talk a little bit about the duty portion of this? I don't believe it was addressed by counsel here, but I did want to. It seemed to me that there may have been some issues of fact lingering, but I certainly can be convinced otherwise. But I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the strip gun club's duty to the decedent and why there was no duty, so much so that there was a cause for a successful dispositive motion.
Well, realize the shooter here was not employed by Fun City. He was employed by the strip gun club. He was not a security guard. He was not a... he was just a safety officer and a firearms instructor. So he wasn't in the course and scope of that when he left his place of employment and went to his residence. And the Fun City, he didn't have a job with Fun City. What bothers me a lot about the duty issues is the things that they raise and don't follow up on. They repeatedly say that my clients assumed a duty, but they don't cite the cases under Nevada law on assumed duty, Wright versus Shum and Dow Chemical. They say that the innkeeper statute applies here, but the innkeeper statute, Chapter 651, was amended in 1995 to change the innkeeper standard and say that hotels, motels, innkeepers are not liable unless there is proof of actual negligence by a preponderance of the evidence. So they're trying to make things look expansive by using certain words when actually there's a failure here to show duty. And unless I can figure out a better answer for Chief Justice Stiglitz, I can end here.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Just a few brief points on rebuttal. First, Justice League, to give you the record citations I promised, if you look to 4 Appendix 708, that's where the Florida court appointed Stephen. And I would also direct the court 4 pages later to 712. This responds to my friend's argument about whether or not this is property that can or cannot be disclaimed. I mean, when you look at what is listed as the estate, one of the things that's listed there, and again, this is at 712, is this claim, this action. So it certainly can. I mean, after all, this state's disclaimer statute talks about disclaiming a power of appointment. It's not simply talking about tangible property. It references intangible property. On my friend's argument about that the legislature has drawn lines, I think that these are lines that they would like for this court to create, but the legislature wrote this statute intentionally. I'm not sure what the legislative history shows. We didn't brief that and neither did they. But be that as it may, again, what controls is the plain text. The plain text is under the laws of the state. It's not under the laws of the state, but not Chapter 134. It's under the laws of this state. As to trying to say, well, this is an assignment, it's not an assignment. The disclaimer statute specifically says a disclaimer is not an assignment. And let's be very clear. I mean, we can go down this a line of where we're saying, okay, well, they disclaim, and then they disclaim, and then they disclaim, and they disclaim. Well, two things. First off, one is if they want to do that, the law allows them to do that.
Does the timing of the disclaimer matter?
So it used to matter under the old statute. It was within 9 months was presumed reasonable, which actually occurred here. And now the disclaimer statute doesn't have anything about the timing, but even if we were under the old statute, her disclaimer within 9 months of his death would be considered reasonable. And again, it's also important that she disclaimed before the suit was brought too. So I think, you know, we can go down this parade of horribles, but the assignment point is more to make sure, as they say in their brief, so that, for example, you can't assign, say, a charitable organization or somebody who has no connection whatsoever to pursue this claim. That's not this case. On the waiver point, I respectfully disagree. I direct the court to pages 17 and 18 of our reply. We brought this up in our motion for reconsideration. The court considered it. It ruled on it. In Cohen versus Pata, which this court is a recent opinion of this court, under those circumstances, it's not waived. I'd also I had somewhere in here where we discussed it in our MSJ. If you look at 3 Appendix 441, we did bring this up in our MSJ response, although admittedly not as full-throated as in our motion for reconsideration. Finally, as to duty, the court has our briefing on this issue. We're not seeking to expand this. If you look to the gun club in particular, I just say there are 6 key facts. One, and this can all be found at reply page 27. People regularly came to the gun club to seek help from motel, from things that were going on in the motel. I see my time is up. I'm happy to finish if the court would like, or I can sit down.
Go ahead, Chief. Yeah, finish your thought.
Thank you. I'll be very brief. Second, the gun club's management was aware that people were doing this. Third, Mr. Trevathan, at the moment that he confronted Keith, he was thinking, do I call 911 or do I go to the gun club to get other employees to help me? Because we've done that in the past and we've gotten them to walk away. Mr. Trevathan then asked Mr. Ranieri if he's okay to be there. Mr. Trevathan directs Mr. Ranieri to stay and observe. And then finally, Mr. Trevathan says, the reason I confronted Keith is because I wanted to prevent Keith from, quote, messing with other customers and from walking to the range to harass anybody in that area. Even if his formal duty was not as a security officer, he implicitly adopted that duty like other gun club employees.
All right. Thank you.
I thank the court for its time.
Thank you,
counsel.
All right. This matter will stand submitted and the court will be in recess. Thank you.